Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Chairman, for that glowing introduction. I remember my mother was once present on an occasion like this, and she said, yes, John just doesn't seem to be able to hold down a job. But it's a great privilege and a flattering one to be invited here tonight. I'd also like to congratulate you, Mr. Chairman, and the organisers for your shrewdness and insight in making tonight's arrangements. Inviting someone to deliver a keynote address on such an occasion is by far the cleverest method yet devised of getting him to pay up his backlog of membership subscription dues. That was done earlier this evening, and I did briefly wonder as I handed over the check if I was still the keynote speaker. But here I am, and I have to admit to being reminded of an incident at a London dinner party a few years ago, given by a magazine editor. When I arrived, I had my coat taken, a glass of wine given to me. I was gestured by my host into the dining room, only to hear the door slammed and locked behind me, to see a plate of sandwiches, a pot of coffee, a typewriter, and a pile of paper on the table, and to hear my host shouting that he and his wife were off to the theatre and dinner and would be back about 1 a.m., which would be plenty of time for me to write my long-promised article. Well, Robert Benchley once remarked that there's no difficulty whatsoever in doing a great deal of work in a short time, provided that it wasn't the work you should be doing. And that option was denied to me that night, so I wrote the article, and tonight I'm delivering the keynote address. I hope at the end of it, Mr. Chairman, that you will think the $1,200 made the whole thing worthwhile. I hope so too, because it's the largest amount I've ever had to pay to deliver a speech in public before. Now, you will recall the old story from British politics about the political dinner at which F.E. Smith was given an introduction so long that when he was finally invited to give his address, he stood up, said 25 Belgrave Square, Southwest 1, and sat down again. Now, tonight I was tempted to commit a similar act of discourtesy, invited here to discuss the topic America and her detractors. I thought I might stand up and say President Barack Obama of the United States and sit down again. It's a temptation I shall resist. It is a temptation because the president is in important ways a detractor of America. I will resist it, though, because though a prominent leader of a whole school of detractors, he is neither the worst nor necessarily the most consequential of America's detractors, some of whom firmly believe themselves to be American patriots. Still, it seems reasonable at least to begin with the president, and in particular with his famous embrace of American exceptionalism. It was an interesting embrace for several reasons. According to Robert Schlesinger of U.S. News & World Report, who did a search through presidential papers, President Obama is the first American president in 82 years to actually use the phrase American exceptionalism. Others had employed patriotic phrases, of course, but not this particular one. And on that occasion, answering a question, he said he was enormously proud of his country. The United States remains the largest economy in the world. We have unmatched military capability. And I think that we have a core set of values that are enshrined in our Constitution and in our body of law, in our democratic practices, in our belief in free speech and equality, that though imperfect, are exceptional. But though fervent, this embrace of American exceptionalism came with terms and conditions attached, like those television advertisements for new wonder drugs. You will recall this key sentence: I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I suspect that the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism. In other words, American exceptionalism is a kind of a run-of-the-mill exceptionalism. We all have one in our attic. Now, I think I'm in a better position to comment on this because I am not an American. I remain a loyal subject of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And I want to begin by arguing that all nations are not exceptional, nor do they even believe themselves to be so. I am sure that there are loyal Bolivian patriots and fervent Romanian nationalists, They love their country. For them, it is God's little acre, and they want it to be free and prosperous. But they recognize that in comparison to the handful of nations which have had a deep impact on the history of the world, that their own nation is somewhat ordinary. The nations that have had a special and deep impact on the world are, in my view, France, Britain, and the United States. If the First World War had not derailed a German-speaking civilization, in 1914, Vienna was already a center of world civilization comparable to London, Paris, and New York, and Berlin was moving to become one. If the First World War had not derailed this process, some kind of wider German polity would probably have emerged as equally influential to the other capitals. Modris Eckstein's demonstrates in his brilliant cultural history of the First World War, The Rites of Spring, that in the 30 years leading up to 1914, Germany was seen as the harbinger of a new spirit of modernity, with followers and admirers all over the world, not least in the United States. But the Great War, Nazism, and the murder and expulsion of the Jews have left German civilization wounded and nervous even to this day. Given the changing balance of world power, with the rise of Asia and the non-Western world and the end of anything like colonial relationships, it looks as if Germany's moment has passed beyond recall, even as it builds a stable prosperity locally. And I think one can say something similar of the Soviet Union and or Russia. In the last 4 years, as Sherman mentioned, I have been working for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Prague. My colleagues were all firm anti-communists, most of whom had taken real personal risks to liberate their countries and to tell the truth about history and politics. None of them mourned the demise of the Soviet Union. But many of them, especially the Central Asians, admitted that the Soviet Union had been a modernizing force for their nations. It enabled people from remote villages to be educated in great universities. It brought an elementary education to every child. It opened opportunities for women. It was a tragedy that their country should have had to enter modern history through its totalitarian door, and that their education led directly to the censorship of what they could read. It meant that the citizens of those countries never imbibed modernity, never digested it emotionally and intellectually, never wanted to become new Soviet man, in the way that African leaders from the former French colonies wanted and still do want to become Frenchmen. That in turn meant that post-Soviet modernity has proved fragile and weak before the challenge of Islamism. A reformed and constitutional czarism, which, remember, Russia was the fifth largest industrial power in 1914, would have modernized those countries more successfully and deeply. But, like Germany, it was derailed by the Great War and later by the Bolsheviks. Russia's time at the top is now never likely to arrive. That leaves, as I mentioned, the three nations that we can say are truly exceptional: France, Britain, and the United States. They have produced great cultural, economic, and social achievements at home. They have had an impact on every corner of the globe. They have influenced the lives of innumerable countries, and most significant of all, they have made people want to be like them. Indeed, actually, to want to be them. In a way, this is the most important point of all: assimilation at home, imitation abroad. Even their enemies fall victim to their charms. Fuad Ajami likes to tell the story of how he was listening to a radical Arab philosopher denouncing the United States on every possible topic. Fuad listened quietly and patiently. Eventually, when the man finished ranting, he simply asked him, "Have your children got their green cards yet?" The man replied, "Bastard." Of France's great achievements, there is no doubt, but they are too large a topic to fit into this speech, and I'm going to concentrate on America, obviously, and to some extent Britain, which, after all, are the two great liberal powers of world history, and therefore the two exceptional powers of world history. To capture the relationship between them, I like to tell an old Cold War joke. An in-tourist guide is taking foreigners around a Moscow museum. He enters a room with two portraits, one large, one small. He indicates the larger portrait. "This is our second greatest inventor, Ivan Ivanovich. He invented submarines, nuclear power, toothpaste, the electric light bulb, the cinema, the telephone, and the Scarsdale diet. The tourists are impressed. Remarkable. And who is in the larger picture? That, ladies and gentlemen, is Stepan Stepanovich. He's our greatest inventor. Oh, that's marvelous, they coo. Well, what did he invent? Oh, he invented Ivan Ivanovich. In exactly the same way, Britain has given the world Shakespeare, the Industrial Revolution, the philosophy of classical liberalism, the abolition of slavery, and the United States of America. Now, that's what I call exceptionalism. On gaining its maturity, however, America promptly universalized the blessings of that civilization, rather as Christianity universalized the teachings of Judaism. It planted freedom in a land where there were fewer obstacles to the flourishing of freedom. It expanded the nation by immigration, but it also assimilated the new immigrants, not only into a new polity, but also into a new society, a new culture, a new identity. In fact, a new state of mind. By a steady expansion, mainly over land, it became a great territory as well as a great power. It manufactured opportunities for its people in a way very few other societies have done or do, or to be fair, have been able to do. I would say, by the way, Australia is another example of this. And having taken over Britain's role as the policeman and banker of last resort in the liberal world civilization during the Second World War, it became the main arbiter of international politics and the main provider of stability by the mid-20th century. Obviously, all this is exceptional. But when academics mention the word, usually with distaste, they mean it in Werner Sombart's sense. America was exceptional, he thought, in not having a working class loyal to the idea of socialism. There were unions, of course, but they didn't have the membership levels of European unions, and as time went on, they saw their role not as working for socialism, but working with the employers to get the best deal for workers in a capitalist enterprise they all wanted to succeed. This social meaning of exceptionalism should not be confined to that topic, the working class and socialism. America was also exceptional in not having a national church, unlike other European countries, including England and Scotland. But that did not mean that religion was neglected or in failing health. On the contrary, the free marketplace of religions in America meant that many religions flourished rather than one failing. In England, by contrast, the Anglican Church has been described as the best inoculation against religion ever devised by man. Until recently, that was slightly unfair. America was exceptional, too, in having women who were independent and self-reliant in comparison with their sisters abroad. Accounts by visitors to America make this clear from the early days of the colonies. They got the vote earlier, too, compared with Europe in the main, not federally, which came late, but in New Jersey and Western states. Of those states which had ethnically mixed, among those countries which had ethnically mixed populations, America was exceptional to the degree in which it succeeded in giving them all a single national identity and encouraging them to speak the same language, adopt the same cultural traits, respect the same national institutions. Compare this success with the constant difficulties of the Habsburgs and of Tsarist Russia, which was, of course, known as the prison house of nations. And one could go on and on, probably ending with the obvious point that America was a functioning democracy with universal male suffrage before the Civil War, approximately 20 years before Britain, and 50 or 60 years before most European nations. And the US did not merely practice democracy, it was a missionary power that preached it too. Now, each one of these achievements made an enemy of someone in Europe. They saw America not as a society at all, but as a materialistic territory devoid of loyalty, solidarity, and poetry. Oswald Spengler said that it was just a place where people were engaged in a squalid dollar hunt. And this continues today. French elections generally revolve around the argument that France must lead Europe's resistance to America's law of the jungle capitalism. And it is very often self-described conservatives who are most pressing on this score. Another common European theme is that Europe has built the social solidarity needed for democracy to be real and practical rather than superficial and formal. Hence the continental preference for social democracy, as statist egalitarian politics is called. Yet if we take the phrase social democracy, deprive it of its proper name status, and look at the words anew, we can see that America is more of a social democracy than any European country, because ordinary citizens feel that their opinions have equal weight with those of the political elites. No continental European thinks that, except perhaps the people in asylums who think they're the equal of the French president because they're Napoleon. And when 9/11 occurred, there were many Europeans who thought that America had it coming because it was too large, too powerful, too full of itself, too successful, too capitalist, too everything. Anti-Americanism is today flourishing throughout the free world. Now, I'm not going to say that such emotions are unknown in Britain. They clearly are not. But they are less febrile there, and they are accompanied by other ideas, other emotions and arguments, which tend to be more on America's side. Britain is often said to be a mid-Atlantic power, and its political culture is a little nearer America than it is to Europe. If you think of America as England's Whig child, then Canada would be her Tory sister. America, Britain, Canada, and the other nations of the English-speaking world are part, and part increasingly, of the same cultural political sphere. They tend to see the world in the same ways and accordingly to act in the same ways, too, in international politics. The writer James C. Bennett has popularized this wider cultural concept in his books and articles on the Anglosphere. He explains the different ways in which what he calls Anglosphere exceptionalism has flowered in different climes when transplanted from the original cultural soil of English individualism, but also how it has retained common features that facilitate an easy cooperation between different Anglosphere countries. Interestingly, this concept has cautious adherents, if not necessarily admirers, on the left. In his very interesting book, America, Between Europe and America, Andrew Gamble, professor of politics at Cambridge University in England, sees what he calls Anglo-America as the hegemonic world civilization for the last 200 years. Its constituent elements include the idea of a global economy governed by free trade and sound finance, respect for property rights, and the idea of a global polity governed by the principles of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. Obviously, in the period which we've been living through, in that 200 years, it is the economic side of that which has been more powerful and impressive, but both sides exist. So the special relationship is one conscious expression in diplomacy, politics, and military affairs of a wider and deeper set of cultural, economic, civil, and even religious understandings. Nor is this an exercise in nostalgia, as some critics tend to assume. Andrew Gamble notes, with what I would describe as reluctant awe, that by the end of the 20th century, the whole world was once more being governed by the Anglo-American conception of a liberal world order. That order was shaken, at least temporarily, by the financial crash of 2008. America and its cultural hinterland in the Anglosphere looks weaker than it did a few years ago, and there are good domestic reasons for that, too. It is therefore going to be challenged more. I'm going to look now at some challenges to America inspired by different kinds of Americanism, anti-Americanism. Different because each case is a case of someone being offended or angered by a particular aspect of American life. The first challenge comes from jihadism, which is offended by the general social freedom of American life, and in particular by its sexual freedom and equality. Now, some conservatives may be tempted to sympathize with this distaste for modern popular culture. And I mean, I do at times myself, until they realize how radical it is. It led, of course, to 9/11. More significantly, it began in the early 1960s when the intellectual founder of Islamism, Sayyid Qutb, who was later executed by the Egyptian government, when he visited Colorado and lived there for 2 years. I'm going to quote you some of Qutb's reactions, quoted in Wikipedia, to provincial American life at the time. I quote, "They danced to the tunes of the gramophone, and the dance floor was replete with tapping feet, enticing legs, arms wrapped around waists, lips pressed to lips, and chests pressed to chest. The atmosphere was full of desire." Later he wrote, The American girl is well acquainted with her body's seductive capacity. She knows it lies in the face and in expressive eyes and thirsty lips. She knows seductiveness lies in the round breasts, the full buttocks, and the shapely thighs, sleek legs. She shows all this and does not hide it. Do you think it's getting a bit warm in here? Couture was particularly disturbed by jazz, which he called the Americans' preferred music and which was created by Negroes to satisfy their love of noise and to whet their sexual desires. It was quite a surprise to learn from Mark Steyn that Couture experienced these shameful scenes at a church social in Greeley. Where nothing more dangerous or seductive than orange juice was served. His writings, however, have influenced Islamic opinion in the years since his execution. And this picture, he portrays America, and a phrase you will know from another Islamist, as the great Satan, a tempter who threatens to undermine decency throughout the Islamic world. This picture, accepted by the young radicals who are looking for ways to expunge the humiliations of Islamic culture in the 20th century, this picture generates a deal of violence on several levels. It is responsible in part for the attack on the Twin Towers, but it also provokes honor killings of Islamic women who want to enjoy the freedoms of Western society. This challenge cannot win, of course, but it can cause enormous trouble, enormous loss of life, and great tragedies in the domestic level. The second challenge comes geographically from Western Europe, but more from the ideology of global governments that is supported by European political elites and that underpins the European Union. Global governance is an alternative system to a different regime to the familiar one of liberal democracy, which is, of course, the system under which we've been living for more than a century. It seeks to take ultimate political power, aka sovereignty, from democratic parliaments and congresses accountable to electorates in sovereign states, and instead to vest that sovereignty in courts, bureaucratic agencies, NGOs, and transnational bodies that are accountable either to themselves or to other transnational bodies. In the international system that prevails under our existing system, legitimacy flows upwards from the voters in elections through sovereign governments and via treaties to international institutions. Those institutions then enjoy specific and limited powers known in advance. Under global governance, however, legitimacy flows downwards from post-national elites in transnational institutions via open-ended treaties to post-sovereign governments enjoying powers regulated by transnational bureaucrats and lawyers. And finally, that sovereignty reaches the voters. Advocates of this second system, global governance, argue that the voters enjoy more real power as a result of pooling, that is, surrendering their sovereignty to transnational bodies carrying greater clout in international affairs. But they are curiously unable to describe how the voters can actually use this greater power. How can they, for instance, amend an international law or vote the European Commission out of office? Or let me put it metaphorically, a bachelor is a sovereign power. A married man enjoys the benefits of shared sovereignty. Now, that's a hard sell, especially to married men. And it's a hard sell to the U.S., since the U.S. is the single largest and most powerful state, nation state, in the international system. We could spend, and it is therefore much more directly opposed, the global governance is much more directly opposed to American interests than it is to the interests of some other countries, also opposed, incidentally, to Israeli interests. Now, I could spend several days here attempting to work out what global governance would actually work out in practice, what it would be like. But why tap the thermometer when you can see the weather, especially if you've just been struck by lightning? Theory need no longer be our only guide. In Europe, global governance advocates have already established an institution that embodies and illustrates some of their fondest beliefs, namely the European Union. It provides us with a trailer of what a system of global governance would look like in practice, as Walter Russell Mead points out. I quote, "Think of the European blown up to a global scale. In the global union, nations would have their own governments and their own laws, but an increasingly dense framework of commonly agreed upon laws and norms and an increasingly complex and effective web of global institutions would supplement and in many cases replace the authority of national governments." And that is putting it reasonably mildly. The current crisis of the euro demonstrates two glaring dangers in such a structure. The first is that unwise and unpopular policies tend to be adopted in the absence of democratic accountability. The second is that even when they have manifestly failed, such policies tend to continue unchanged in the absence of democratic accountability. The long-running failure of the common agricultural policy, which ruins the export prospects of small third world farmers in order to sustain high food prices for European consumers at a cost equal to 40% of the EU's budget, shows the CAP shows that such policy, folly rather, can be, actually fallacy is not a bad word, shows that such folly can be maintained more or less indefinitely or until the entire structure runs out of cash and thereby collapses. Elites, we can see, are far more unwilling to give up their fantasies than practical-minded ordinary voters, in part because the elites do not have to suffer the negative aspects of utopia. The triumph of global governments would therefore risk repeating the unpopular failures of the EU on a world scale and at Brobdingnagian expense. The third challenge is one that involves, finally, President Obama. It is the challenge for multiculturalism and deconstructionism when looking at the identity of the United States. The American nation, as it developed from the colonial period to the 1960s, was built around certain core institutions, customs, and practices. To oversimplify brutally, these were the English language, dissenting Protestant Christianity, individualism and the work ethic, and the political culture of the Founding Fathers with its emphasis on individual rights. Over time, later immigrant groups assimilated to this core of Anglo-Protestant Christianity that evolved from those origins, and they assented to the American creed that was its self-conscious political expression. They added cultural contributions of their own, but these did not fundamentally alter the national character. And by the late 1950s, Americans were one nation of individuals with equal political rights who shared a primarily Anglo-Protestant core culture and were dedicated to the liberal democratic principles of the American creed. Those last few words are from Samuel Huntington, who has greatly influenced my thinking on this. One point here, which may be controversial, is that America is not and was not a proposition nation whose national identity consists of adherence to the liberal principles of the American creed, as neoconservatives and libertarians are wont to argue. The American creed is certainly part of America's national identity. It is the distilled essence of American culture. But it is too abstract and too theoretical to provide a fulfilling patriotism or identity on its own. Men sacrifice, you've got to have the willingness to sacrifice. Men sacrifice themselves for home and beauty, for the comradeship of a battle, for loyalty to the flag, to ensure that the experience of a free life is not lost to their children. They are very unlikely to sacrifice themselves for political ideas unless they also convey this range of loyalty. And I'm also arguing that the creed does not sufficiently distinguish Americans from people in other countries. If belief in liberty and individual rights were sufficient to make one an American, half the people in the world could claim American citizenship. And if the creed is seriously taken to be the totality of American identity, then the way is open for multiculturalism that treats the English language, US history, and American cultural practices from baseball to hard work as simply one set of options in a cultural and ethnic smorgasbord. A smorgasbord, moreover, in which preference for traditional American beliefs and customs counts as discrimination. Of course, too, words and ideas take a good portion of their meaning from the surrounding culture. So our current understanding of concepts such as liberty would be significantly altered if we were to interpret them in the light not of an Anglo-Protestant liberty culture, but of Hispanic, Confucian, or Islamic culture, or even of continental Roman law. I don't believe that anxieties of that kind are alarmist. Judge Bork has pointed out many times that the US Supreme Court justices have been advocating that the American courts take account of legal precedents from courts as remote as the European Court, and indeed even the Zimbabwe Supreme Court. It would be a tremendous irony, wouldn't it, if the Zimbabwe Supreme Court ended up exercising more influence in the US than it does in Zimbabwe. But if this is alarmism, it may be early warning alarmism. Now, about 1965, or just after the Civil Rights Act had finally brought black America fully within the ambit of the American political nation, influential Americans set about systematically attempting to demolish this impressive structure. I mentioned Samuel Huntington. I'm going to give you a quote from him, which I think says it all. "The deconstructionists promoted programs to enhance the status and influence of subnational, racial, ethnic, and cultural groups. They encouraged immigrants to maintain their birth country cultures, granted them legal privileges denied to Native Americans, and denounced the idea of Americanization as un-American. They pushed the rewriting of history syllabi and textbooks so as to refer to the peoples of the United States in place of the single people of the Constitution. They urged supplementing or substituting for national history the history of these subnational groups. They downgraded the centrality of English in American life and pushed bilingual education and linguistic diversity. They advocated legal recognition of group rights and racial preferences over the individual rights central to the American creed. They justified their actions by theories of multiculturalism and the idea that diversity, rather than unity or community, should be America's value. The combined effect of these efforts was to promote the deconstruction of the American identity that had been gradually created over three centuries and the ascendance of subnational identities." Now, how did this extraordinary alteration happen? And I think an alteration which everyone around the table, has got to admit has gone very far indeed and established itself and put down roots, so that changing it will be a very major task. How did this happen? Well, the truth is that America's elites, both the corporate elites of the right and the academic elites of the left, do not share the opinions and tastes of the American people. Huntington argued that both elites had in effect been denationalized by the processes of economic and cultural globalization. They are more likely to share the tastes and opinions of their counterparts in other countries than those of their own countrymen in provincial and small-town America. They regard patriotism and national feeling as atavistic emotions that retard either economic rationality, the right, or cosmopolitan ideologies of democratic humanism, the left. And they see America not as a nation like other nations, if more powerful, but as the embryo either of the global market or of a new universal nation, one without boundaries or restrictive citizenship. In other words, the exceptionalism that the left sees and that the president sees is an exceptional America because it's a completely different America invented in the last 40 years. On a whole range of policy issues, racial preferences, bilingual education, military intervention abroad, open borders, the American people are firmly on one side and the American elites are on the other. This produces a lot of bad results. Cynicism about government, electoral abstention, rebellious referendum initiatives like Proposition 187 and 209, in which the voters briefly impose their will on the elites, which then strike back in the courts. Now, I think I must come to the end, but because there's a substantial counterintelligentsia. The elites have become, and this is, I think, much more evident in the presidency of President Obama than any previous president. and it reflects changes that have already occurred, so that what he, when you see him attempting to bring about a different kind of America, he is far more able to do it plausibly than he would have been able to do it 30 years ago, because so many of the groundwork has been laid. Well, my final point is to say that President Obama and those in the elites who want to go further with him down this road are the patriots of an exceptional America, because it is an America that doesn't actually exist. The America of multiculturalism, bilingualism, and diversity that can live without a common European culture. They therefore hate the America that does exist as an obstacle to their dreams, and they tend to sympathize with attacks upon it and to react against anyone who defends it. I'm afraid that Mr. Obama and others are leaders of this tendency, and they are anxious to see that America win out over the America of history. Now, that leaves then just to say one final thing. Who is the final group of people whom we must blame? And I'll be very brief here. It is ourselves. If we look at the crisis in which America is in today, a crisis which combines financial problems, economic problems, as Charles Murray has just demonstrated to us, social problems, and as we've been just discussing, the problem of a culturally antagonistic elite, then these things could not have happened if we had not been more active as citizens. Not the people around in this room, of course, I know, but if the American people alone, the American people in a broader sense, had not been prepared to see these things happen. We have an obligation, it seems to me now, to take action, as the Tea Party, for example, has done, to reverse so many of the trends I've just been talking about in the last 5 minutes. And finally this. One of our problems is, of course, a political culture, a popular culture that used to be one of the most decent and attractive popular cultures in the world, and which is one of the reasons for the popularity of America, and which still got very great achievements to its credit, but which is increasingly brutalistic and vulgar. And so I end with a line from Alan Bennett's play about the decline of England 40 years on. Mark my words, when a society goes to the lavatory for its humor, the writing is on the wall.